Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. For more than 150 years, a magical culture has been central to the game of baseball. At the turn of the 20th century, a battle between two lucky mascots defined early World Series matchups. Soon after, two generational curses spawned decades of heartbreaking losses for the Chicago Cubs and the Boston Red Sox. Today, players like Bryce Harper perform at-bat rituals, and fans refuse to wash the jerseys of their favorite players, and baseball people everywhere refuse to utter the words no-hitter before there's been a hit. In her new book, The Magical Game, Salt Lake Tribune reporter and converted baseball fan Addie Baird turns her reporter's eye to her favorite sport, investigating the roots of these magical practices and telling the story of baseball's long history of superstition, rituals, curses, jinxes, hoodoos, and hexes. Addie Baird is a writer, reporter, and baseball fan. With a background in political investigative journalism, she's written and worked for BuzzFeed News, Politico, Vice, The Daily Beast, The New Republic, and the Salt Lake Tribune, among other outlets. She's a Mets fan and an astrologer. Addie Baird, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tom. It's great to be here.
So listeners will be familiar with Addie Baird on our other program, Beyond the Headlines, but today a very fun topic here about baseball and rituals, superstitions, and the like. I want to start with you, Addie Baird. You write that you were not a baseball fan growing up. In fact, I loved how you put it. You went to NYU, right? And you were proud that your university didn't even have a football team.
It's true. Yeah, I grew up here in Utah, and I graduated from high school, and I went to NYU, and I really looked down my nose at sports, and I was totally proud to go to a school without a football team. And while I was at NYU, in 2015, the Mets went to the World Series, and it's so fun to think about this when the Knicks just won, and you know, everyone has seen what happened in the city, and it was a taste of that with the Mets in the World Series. It felt like that, and the city was so alive, and I started to sense it, and I wanted to be a part of it, even though I didn't care about sports at all. And I called my father, and I asked him if he had ever been to a World Series game, and he laughed. He was like, what a crazy question. And he ended up coming to New York and swinging it and getting tickets and taking me to this game. And it was this like incredibly special experience that I got to have with my dad. And the game itself was really remarkable. It was the first game that the Mets played in New York after losing two in Kansas City against the Royals, and they won. And the game was genuinely so magical. The first strikeout was unlike anything I had ever experienced, and I got it. I totally got it. And at the end of the game, we had been chatting with some people sitting around us, and I was sitting right next to some Mets season ticket holders, and one of them took my hands and he said, "You're a Mets fan now." And I was like, "Totally, of course." And he was like, "It's gonna suck."
And I imagine it has.
They've
lost a lot more than they won. Yes.
You know, it has. Like, it's so prescient and it's so honest and it's so real. But also, it has been so much fun. It has been an absolute pleasure. And I always tell people, it's easy to be a fan of a bad team. The scariest parts of being a Mets fan are the couple times they've been in the playoffs since I've been watching. And it has sucked, but it has given me everything. It's given me this book. It's connected me to so many people. And it's almost zen the way I've come to love the suffering.
So before we get to the magic, what is it about the game that you love?
What a great question, because it's hard for me to separate that from the magic, but I think that baseball is unique. There is so much of it. And whenever people are like, "Oh, I could never really be a baseball fan. There's just too many games." I'm like, you don't get it. That's the point. I love being in this summer-long experience of every day watching my team win or lose. And it really is, it's almost meditative, it's almost zen, the way that even with the Mets, I can be like, well, it's one loss, you know, we move on, we go to the next one, we're back tomorrow night. I love the summertime of it. I think there's something that really appeals to like the nostalgic child in all of us about baseball, that school's out in our hearts and we get to enjoy the summertime game. I also think that the game itself is so special. There is, even with the pitch clock, there's no game clock. It is infinite. It's only over when it's over. And there's something so special about the way that creates this infinite hope and this kind of timeless pocket outside of time. And I think it is such a special game. I love the history of it. I love the way that it lends itself to superstition. I love the way that it's intertwined with America and our history. I think it is a really unique and a really special game.
Let's talk about magic. Why, there are superstitions in other sports, but baseball seems to really lend itself to magic, superstition, hexes, curses, and the like. What is it about baseball that connects itself so intertwined with magic?
Yeah. This is, I think, one of the first questions that I really started to dive into with this book, because surely, we see other sports are superstitious. If you know hockey fans, they're very superstitious. I am a Knicks fan. We just had a very superstitious run in our home. But baseball is unique. I think it's a couple things. I think one, it's that baseball, the very way that the game is constructed, lends itself to superstition. All of the science of superstition says that superstition is more likely to develop when we have an action that is repeated many times and the response to that action is very quick. So, for example, you have someone who is at bat and they perform their superstitious ritual at the plate, and then a pitch comes across the plate. And that is a very quick test of that superstitious behavior. Again, it also is amplified by the fact that they're doing this again and again. They're taking many swings, many at bats in a game. So this repeatability and this quick response, that's what the science shows us, that it's really going to lend itself to superstitious behavior. So I think the daily nature, the repeatability of the game absolutely is part of it. I think the other aspect of it is that baseball has such a power imbalance. It's the only sport of our, four major North American sports where the defense has the ball and the offense has such a significant power imbalance. At best, the offense has four people on the field. And all of the game, you've got defense who has nine people on the field. So there's this great imbalance. And the research about science, the research about the science of superstition shows us also that we're more likely to engage in magical thinking, superstitious behavior, when the odds are stacked against us. So when you look back, some of the earliest research about when we're using magic is about island fishers. And Malinowski looks at these, this anthropologist, Bronislaw Malinowski, looks at these island fishers. And when they fish in the inner lagoons, where the waters are safe and the fish are plentiful, they don't use ritual to prepare themselves to fish. But when they fish in the open ocean, where the waters are uncertain and more dangerous, and the catch is also uncertain, but there's a greater potential gain, there's all sorts of magical ritual associated with fishing in the open ocean. I think the exact same thing is true of baseball. It's exactly the same kind of thinking. It is uncertain. It's dangerous. I think it's easy for us to think about baseball as being a like a almost a low contact sport, but baseball is dangerous. People get hurt. A ball to the head has been genuinely deadly. So in these uncertain and dangerous situations, baseball players turn to magic, as do fans, as do managers, as do announcers. So I think it's just a perfect storm. It appeals to the human brain, it appeals to the human psyche, and the game is perfectly constructed for this kind of magical practice.
Before we go forward, I want to follow up on the Knicks. that struck me. So you I guess as many fans, probably Knicks and Spurs fans were doing, you were helping them along with it. Did you have ritual at home
to help them?
What did you do?
My boyfriend, who is from New York, is a lifelong Knicks fan, and he really has converted me to the Knicks. And there's a chapter in my book where I interview a Mariners fan, and I was thinking about him so much during the Knicks run, because he talks about how he doesn't have specific superstitions. He doesn't do the same thing in every single game, but in every single game that the Mariners play, he does this thing where he's kind of reading the energy and responding to it and intuitively doing what feels right. And that is how the superstition felt for me and my partner as the Knicks went on this run. We were absolutely wearing like the same clothes. I would wear the same hat. They won 15 games out of like this run of 16. And the only game they lost was game 3 at home. And so when they lost that game, I had to stop wearing the hat and I had to totally reset the outfit. So the outfits, the Knicks gear were really important. Repeating that, I had a book signing and I didn't have my Knicks hat on while they were playing. And I had joked to my boyfriend, like, once I'm done with my talk, I can put the hat on and they'll rally. And he was like, don't say that. Like, we don't need that. Like, don't admit that they're going to need to rally. And I'm signing books and he brought me the hat and he was like, they need to rally. And I put the hat on and they rallied from down 14. So the clothes, the hats were really magical, but it was game 4 when the Knicks were at home and they had been down 29 points and we were at our house watching at home and we were just really anxious and so upset and we had to like reset the energy. So we muted the TV, we put a record on, we started playing chess and I was facing away from the TV and my boyfriend was watching and he would tell me when things would happen. And while I was not watching, the Knicks went on this 29-point comeback, the biggest comeback in the history of the NBA Finals. And every time I would turn around to try to peek at what was going on, it would be like crazy Spurs 3 or something bad would happen to the Knicks. So I stopped turning around and I experienced the Knicks 29-point comeback with my boyfriend announcing it to me while my back was to the TV while we played chess, because that was what was working when the comeback started. And so we had to keep it going.
And it worked.
It worked.
They broke a curse of sorts after 53 years. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So that illustrates this is not just players, right? That players are dealing, as you said, with the danger of the game, the unpredictability, the difficulty of the game. What's going on with fans? I'm well familiar with this, right? So the kind of the body English, even though you're not playing, right? Willing your team on to victory. Fans definitely participate in rituals and superstition and the like.
Yeah, fan magic is really interesting because when we look at player superstitions and player rituals, there's a lot of science to back up the effectiveness of it. Basically, researchers say that there's a disparate outcome between the performance of the ritual and the outcome of the actual at-bat or the outcome of the actual performance in any sport. But there's an absolute connection that we can demonstrate between the performance of the ritual and the way that it grounds the player. It makes them feel confident. It puts them in a headspace where they believe that they are going to succeed. And it works. It is successful. It is effective. And it is backed by science for players to participate in rituals. It makes less sense for fans. There's less of a direct connection. The impact on the game, we don't have. But I think it's the same thing in a lot of ways where athletes perform the ritual to calm themselves and to feel like they are in control. That's exactly how I felt playing chess and not watching the Knicks, was that it was the only thing that I could do. It felt like I don't have an impact on the game. I can't be out there on the floor, but I can sit here and do my superstitious behavior, and it makes me feel a little calmer. It makes me feel in a moment that's so scary when I want them to win so bad, Like if I'm engaging in my superstition, it calms me down. And it's the only way that I could theoretically impact the game. And so if I do it, I can go, okay, I did my part. And if I don't do it, if I'm turning around and I'm peeking at the game, I'm like, oh, well, now I've failed. I didn't do my part here. But it is really interesting. I love fan superstition because it's got a very pure magical streak to it. And my book, I'm a journalist. I love magic. I love superstition. And I believe in it. I think there's something real about the collective consciousness and the collective energy that we can tap into with these magical practices. But I wanted this to be a book that is engaged with the science and the psychology of magic and the history of magic. And fan superstition is just so interesting because of almost every single form of magic that I look at in the book, it's almost the most purely magical because of the way that we are as fans disconnected from the game. But it brings us together and it makes us feel like we're a part of it.
Before we go to break, I want to dive into, you have a section of the book where you talk about, well, let's define magic. What's take me briefly through that. And it kind of intertwined with religion, right? So what is magic?
It's a hard question to answer, and we've been debating it for a long time. As you say, a lot of people have defined magic in this in the question of what it is not. It is not religion, it is not science. I really explore many definitions of magic, Freud's definition, Jung's definition, the definitions of many scientists and historians over the years, and I land on a definition used by archaeologist Chris Gosden, who says that magic is human participation in the universe, and that magic, religion, and science are not three disparate things, but rather an interconnected DNA helix of human engagement with the world and with the cosmos. And that was the definition that really resonated with me that I used throughout the book.
I found this in an article you wrote for the Tribune about your book. You were raised Latter-day Saint, and you say that that background really, I don't know, got you into magic, prepared you for magic. Tell me about that.
Yeah, it's funny because I think that there might be a lot of members of the church who would bristle at the idea that the church made me love magic, but I do think it's true. I think it inclined, I'm not an active member anymore, but the church inclined me to believe that there is something else going on in the universe. And even though I've left the church, that sense that the church instilled in me has stayed with me, that there is something else going on. There's a higher power, there's something else at play. And it made me interested in mysticism and spirituality and the greater, context of the cosmos in which we live. And I love that so much about the church and growing up in the church. I think in a lot of ways, it is the original seed for my love for all of these things, this mystical, magical world that I delve into in the book. I think it really does go back to my childhood as a member of the LDS Church.
You front of the book, you have a quote from my fictional character, Annie Savoy from Bull Durham. Most of us have seen Bull Durham. Annie Savoy, a wonderful character. And she says, "I believe in the Church of Baseball. I've tried all the other major religions, most of the minor ones, the Church of Baseball." And I think we intuitively, kind of sense baseball, if you're going to have a church of a sport, baseball's the one that probably lends itself to that.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that quote, and it's so me. I've had an expansive relationship to spirituality and spiritual practices, and she says I've tried them all. I really have. And that's me. That is so me. And she says the only church that feeds the soul day in, day out is the Church of Baseball. And I think baseball is special in that way. It inclines itself to a spiritual practice and a worship of a daily game. It's really a road to God.
Now I can hear religious people shuddering that Church of Baseball, you're being heretical there, but for many people that really is, it really Well, at least for some people, it approaches that, right? It's a mystical experience for them.
Yes, and I think, you know, what I would say to anyone shuddering right now is that I think that there is this Buddhist saying where they say, don't confuse the finger for the moon. And they mean when somebody points at the moon, don't look at the finger, look at the moon. The idea is that the point is not the teachings. The point is where it takes you. The point isn't to meditate. It's to get free. It's to wake up. It's to be enlightened. I think that is the heart of all religious and all spiritual experiences, that I think people with a deep relationship with religion and spirituality can understand that the doctrine, the teaching, the scriptures, they are the finger, and God is the moon. Freedom is the moon. Oneness is the moon. And I think baseball is just another finger pointing at the moon.
Well, we're talking with Addie Baird. She is a Salt Lake Tribune reporter and author now of the new book. It's called The Magical Game. It's out and available now. We're talking about it. It's available, a wonderful book. And we'll have more with this following this brief break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We have with us today Addie Baird. You know her as a Salt Lake Tribune reporter. She's out with a book. It's called The Magical Game, and that is out and available now. So we're talking with Addie Baird about the book. Addie Baird, what if you tell, early in the book, you tell a wonderful story about, I guess this is a bit following the heading of superstitions. This is the New York Giants. John McGraw is their manager, and they're in a huge slump. None of their hitters can hit. And then one day, there's a superstition. One of the players sees a truck full of empty barrels.
Yeah. Yeah, I love this story. It was one of my obsessions when I was reporting out this book, because I had heard tell of this story and I couldn't track down exactly what happened. And finally, I'd gone to Cooperstown, where the Baseball Hall of Fame is, and they have a wonderful library. And I finally was in the library and found some old reporting about this story that finally put the key in the lock for me. And the story was even better than I could have imagined. As you mentioned, the Giants were in a slump. They were being managed by one of the all-time great managers. And McGraw heard this player say, oh, I saw a load of empty barrels today on my way to the polo grounds, and I'm gonna hit well today. And he had an idea. So he hired a carriage driver with a load of empty barrels to drive around near the polo grounds where they played every day. And all these players started to come into work every day and be like, oh, I saw a load of empty barrels. I'm going to play well. And they started to play well. They started to get themselves out of the slump, and they started to win. And it was happening for so many of them, and it was turning around the season. And one day, a couple players were like, isn't it weird that we always see the same horses carrying these barrels? And they were like, yeah, that is weird. I always see the same ones too. And McGraw finally spoke up, and he said, I hired them. What was I supposed to do? Get them to change the horses every day? And they all had a laugh, but it worked. And I think it's a story that encapsulates a lot of the threads I pull on in this book, which is that magic is real when we believe it's real. Our brains are so powerful. Our manifesting power as human beings is so immense. And McGraw had this instinct to pull on that thread, and it worked. The team turned around. They got themselves out of this slump. And it's just such an amazing story of the way that superstition works.
Yeah, you say, you know, that magic's real if you believe it's real, right? You can will yourself, but through this, you know, through this realm to do better. So I got a whole range of things, right? Rally caps, Don't touch the foul line, right? Don't wash your jersey, all those kinds of things.
Yeah, and they go back such a long time. There's a rare pamphlet called Baseball from the newspaper accounts. I believe it's 1886. And it is as far back as, you know, the 1880s. We see players doing many superstitions that we would recognize today, like you mentioned, not stepping on the foul lines, not changing their jerseys when they're winning. It's something innate to the game. It's so ancient. And that was the other thing I was looking at. I wanted to figure out, when did this begin? When did baseball superstition really take hold? And the answer is, as long as we've played baseball, we've been doing magic about it. Because as long as we've been human, we've been doing magic about it. And yeah, we see such a long legacy of these kinds of practices. It's not stepping on the foul lines, which, as with many superstitions, has some seemingly some grounding in reality. Because in the early days of baseball, the mounds were raised. The lines would be actual raised mounds of dirt. And players, if you stepped on it, maybe you'd twist an ankle or you'd trip or you'd just squish the foul line. And so they would step over the line. And now their line's just painted on the field. But there's something, there's a little bit of reason and reality to its history that I think helps it make a little more sense of the way that it becomes ingrained in the sport.
Tell me about human mascots. These days, mascots are human. They're wearing a costume. But back in the day, you had just guys that would just be there, and they're kind of the lucky talisman for the team.
Yeah, it was literally just guys. So it's interesting. Tom and I were talking about this before we started recording. Like, when I first started doing this research and I kind of came upon this idea of the mascots, I was so surprised. And I guess it does make sense. Like, it's we're so used to mascots being costumed people. But, you know, it's funny to imagine like a baseball game in the 1870s and seeing a giant costumed animal. Like, it doesn't make sense. But they had mascots, and they would be people that they considered lucky. There's a story that I tell early in the book about a young man who was the mascot for the A's, who was so lucky to them. They would make sure that he went to mass to keep his luck in. He was a young boy. He had had an accident when he was young. And he was this kid that they just loved, and they really believed that he was their magic spell. And the Giants also, they were rivals with the A's, and they had a mascot of their own. His name was Charles Victory Faust. And he had a dream. A psychic told him that he would be a pitcher for the Giants. And he went to McGraw and he said, "I had this dream." And McGraw kind of made it real. He put Faust on the roster, and Faust would warm up in every game like he was going to pitch. And he didn't pitch. He was their mascot, but he was their lucky charm. When we look at the widespread practice of this, there was a lot of racism associated with it in the early days. Young black men were often used as lucky mascots, and players would rub their heads. And there's this discomfort of looking at this that I think kind of explains how we end up with mascots that are costumed and charactered and animals, because there's something uncomfortable looking back at, like, particularly these young black men around the turn of the century being used as mascots and treated as sort of objects in a way that's uncomfortable. But it is a very interesting piece of baseball history, and it's intricately tied to superstition. I don't know if we think of mascots now as being lucky. They just are. Everyone has one. But that is really the heart of them. That's where they started, was that they were people believed to bring luck to the team.
And it's interesting, once the magic ended, it ended for both of these mascots
it
that you
ended.
Talked about. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, when this young man who was the lucky mascot for the A's, his run kind of ended. He died soon after. There's an old report that describes the A's loss in the World Series. He had won a few with them, and after they lost the World Series, it was a sports writer said like a Waterloo to this young lucky mascot, and he died soon after. It was so devastating. And after he died, it was the best run of the careers of the manager and the team. They won five World Series in, I believe, five or 6 years. They were in the World Series on a real string. I wish I had the exact numbers in front of me, but over the years that would come after that, nothing was even close. It was about 4 and 48 years. There's something real going on there.
So, magic is an excellent definition. You got human participation in the universe. So, superstition, I guess we're trying to make sense of the universe, trying to control something that's not controllable.
So I think the way that the book is set up, the whole overarching thing is human participation in the universe, and then each chapter we go with a different form of magic and we look at how it particularly manifests and is used. And superstition, I think, is an interesting one. I think of superstition as being both rituals and jinxes. I think of superstition as being a little bit more contained. It's a little more personal, in contrast to something like curses, which takes on, it's generational and it spans so many years and it becomes a legacy that a whole team holds, a whole town holds. But superstition and jinxes are kind of two sides of the same coin. Superstition being this act of performing a ritual to call on something good, whereas jinxes are something that you avoid doing to avoid bad energy coming into your game.
You write there's something so special about the grand ritual of the daily game. You talked about this a little bit. And then you talk about the micro rituals within the game itself, the national anthem, pre-batting superstitions, seventh inning stretch. So some of this is, I guess, less magical than others, but rituals that draw people into the game. You come and there are certain things that happen every time.
Yes. And I think you're right. We have this instinct of the difference between something truly magical, like I'm wearing the same clothes, I'm not watching the TV while the Knicks play. It's this real magical thinking versus almost the routine of the game. But when we think of magic as human participation in the universe, I think there is magic to these kind of micro rituals, to the national anthem, to the first pitch, to the seventh inning stretch, because it is us engaging in the universe, in the world, in being human, in enjoying the game, in marking time in special ways. And we're not really asking for an outcome with these. That I think is an interesting distinction. But we are 100% engaging in a ritual, and it's magical. And there's something really special about the way that it is, there's this routine to even just going to a baseball game that we all know and we're all familiar with, and it helps us to mark time and it helps us to drop into the experience.
Now, many of these are old as the game itself, but it's the game is prone to new rituals. I'm thinking of Boston Red Sox and Sweet Caroline.
Yes. Totally. It's very sweet to see them emerge. I think the game produces them. I'm a Mets fan, and Francisco Lindor, who's hurt, I praying for his recovery. But his at bat song is My Girl, and he will take his time out before his at bat so that the stadium can sing the chorus of My Girl. I feel like I'm gonna cry talking about it. It's so special. And we see things like that all over the league and all over, everything from little league up to the major leagues. And Yeah, I think baseball is just inclined and built to produce those kinds of rituals that fans and players alike engage in.
You mentioned curses. Let's take a break. I want to talk about curses. It's especially two specific teams, the Chicago Cubs and Boston Red Sox, who broke their long-term curses. This has ancient roots as well. We'll talk about that when we come back. We're talking with Addie Baird, Salt Lake Tribune reporter and author now of a new book. It's called The Magical Game. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Addie Baird. She's out with a new book, interesting books called The Magical Game. We're talking about that on the program today. Addie Baird, before we get to curses, I assume a lot of this, magic, superstitions, rituals, jinxes, this is human. This is worldwide, I assume. And baseball has spread to, it's big in Dominican Republic, Venezuela, obviously Japan. Are there similar kinds of superstitions, et cetera, in these countries?
Yes, totally. There's a lot of interesting research about the way that superstition plays into the game worldwide. We see absolutely with Latin American players in the major leagues, we see them engaging in superstition. We see the same thing with Japanese players. We see, because again, I think the game inclines itself to this. We do see some interesting cultural differences across the countries. There's an interesting study about superstition in the United States and in Japan. And one of the big differences is that Japanese players actually engage in less specific superstition to improve their performance. They are more likely to do, a ritual in the game that is intended to help the team and not just selfishly help them. Whereas with players in the US, there's a lot of superstition related to your individual performance. And it's interesting, you can kind of see the way that these split our cultural differences. And there's a really wonderful documentary. It's called Koshien Japan's Field of Dreams. It's about the summer high school baseball tournament in Japan. And it's one of my favorites because you can see the way that Japanese players have ritualized every aspect of the game and of practice and of the summer tournament. And it's really unique. It's a different flavor of ritual than we have with our baseball here in the US, and it's very special. It's very cool.
Let's talk about curses. I was telling you before we went on the air that my father was a Chicago Cubs fan. Some of my favorite photos of him are in his Cubs cap. He was proud of his lovable losers, as he called them, and he died before they broke the curse. But I wish he would have been here for that. You write in the book that curses, it's again, that's very human. Go back to ancient Greece. You had your rivals in chariot races, right? Putting curses on each other.
Yes. Also, it just as I said before, it's so heartbreaking and beautiful and touching to me to hear this about your father. And there's so many stories like that. They were cursed for so long. It's crazy. But yes, there's something incredibly human about this. Curses are as far back as we have evidence of human civilization, we have evidence of curses. There are tablets, there are thousands and thousands of tablets that archaeologists understand to be curses. And there were sorcerers and magicians and town, witches that would help people to perform them. And early on, you look back to like the 4th century CE, and we see sports curses. We see, as you mentioned, people who pay a town sorcerer essentially to curse the chariot team. And there's such a heartbreaking curse I think about all the time. Early on in our evidence of this kind of thing, where a chariot team is cursed to have a bad night's sleep. And it just kills me. I can't think of a worse curse.
In the book, you quote Ed Hartig, I can't remember what his credentials are, who says, "If you believe you're cursed, you're cursed."
Yes, and get this, Ed is the Chicago Cubs official historian. So
Okay, yes.
he would know.
Yeah.
But yes, I think it's the same thing. It's, whereas if we believe our ritual, our superstition is going to help us succeed, it probably will. Same thing is true with curses. If you believe you're cursed, you're cursed. And the curses have just ballooned and expanded in this way where, I'm sure you are familiar with this with the Cubs. Everyone believed that they were cursed, and everyone believed that if things were going well, they would fall apart. They weren't going to succeed. And what could be more cursed than always believing that failure is just right around the corner?
Now, the non-magical way of saying how you break the curse is to hire Theo Epstein as your general manager. He was the general manager of both the Red Sox and the Cubs. He belongs in the Hall of Fame. Probably we'll get there someday. But what's the magical view of how do you get out of a curse?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. Theo Epstein belongs in the Hall of Fame. And to your point, I think that even the magical answer for breaking a curse, we couldn't hack it with the Cubs and with the Red Sox. There's so many attempts. People killed goats and sent them to the Cubs owner. Like, people tried all sorts of magical ways, saging and sacrifice to end the curse. But curses, I think, are interesting because, as you mentioned, it's Theo Epstein who is the GM of both these teams when they break their curses. I look at some other curses. I look at a cursed team in Japan. I look at, the Angels, who I really believe are cursed. And the answer is that the only real curse is the curse of bad management. And when you sell the team, you get a new manager, like that's what happens. It's this clearing out of the energy and this bringing in of somebody who's willing to do it different, who's willing to spend money, who's willing to construct a different kind of lineup. That's how you break a curse. It's so practical. It's almost funny.
It's interesting. Some teams have been so bad for so long, but really hasn't built up a curse or a mythology of a curse around them. Colorado Rockies, for example,
Yeah.
right next door in Denver, so bad so long, but it hasn't really built up. As far as I know, there hasn't been a mythology of a curse around them.
Yeah, I think it could emerge, but I think it's interesting. Like when we think about our history, our Platonic ideal of cursed teams, it's the Sox and the Cubs. And the Sox and the Cubs have been around for so long. They go back to the earliest days of the major leagues, and compared to them, the Rockies are new. So I think that maybe the Rockies need more time. I think there's, and I write about this in the book, there's kind of a three-part recipe for a curse. And that's the very first thing. You have to be around for a long time. You have to be around long enough for a losing streak to get narrativized. And that's the other thing is that you need the media. You need a local reporter. In every case of a curse, there's a local reporter that's really synthesizing it into a story and making the argument that it is the curse. And the third part is you need bad management and bad ownership, that really takes the regular randomness of the game and underperforms to a level that's really remarkable. But it's funny because everyone wants to be cursed, which might sound strange, but it was what I found when I was working on this book and I would tell people, "Oh, I'm writing about baseball superstition," and I was working on curses for a long time. I actually wrote 30,000 words about curses, and about 10,000 made it into the book, but I was obsessed. And I spent a long time in my curse research, and I would tell people, "Okay, I'm writing about curses." And everyone would respond being like, oh, are the Guardians cursed? Oh, are the Rockies cursed? Like, people wanted their team to be cursed. And I thought that was so strange. And I started to look into that. And I was talking to a fan of the Hanshin Tigers, which was a long-suffering, cursed baseball team in Japan. And this Tigers fan told me that the Tigers recently broke their curse. And he said that after it ended, he had this moment of being like, what's the point? That there was something actually that he didn't even realize that he loved and that he wanted about being cursed. And that really made sense to me on some strange level because I'd seen how many people wanted there to be a curse on their team. And I think there's a few reasons for that. I think one, a curse narrativizes our suffering. It gives us a reason and it gives us a chance to do something about it, to sage, to sacrifice, whatever it might be. It feels like as fans, we could take it. If it's supernatural, then we could take up the supernatural. We don't manage the roster, we don't play on the field, but we can do magic. And so it almost puts it into our control. It's also that anticipation is nine-tenths of delight. I felt this with the Knicks. It was such a pleasure when they won, but the anticipation of it and the run that they went on and the remarkable 53-year drought to see it end, it was so special to watch it happen that when it actually happened, I was like, what am I supposed to do now?
Yeah, there is that feeling, that's for sure. Yeah. Just a couple of minutes left. I want to give the very short version of Chapter 8, The Death of Magic, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Pitch Clock. You were not happy when that was instituted, but you've come around. Still some magic, I guess, even though the games are sped up.
I was, as we began this conversation, a converted baseball fan, and I have always fashioned myself as a very modern fan. I have no problem with bat flips. I have no problem with, fighting. I have no problem with it. I think it's fun. I have no problem with sabermetrics. And when they instituted the pitch clock, I was working on my proposal for this book, and I proposed this chapter 8, to be about the magic being dead. I thought they were killing the game by instituting the pitch clock. I was really upset. But I am, at my heart, a well-trained investigative reporter, and I started to report out this question of whether the magic was dead, and I discovered that my hypothesis was very wrong. People have been saying that baseball is dead, its magic is dead, it is not the game that it once was since the 1860s. And by engaging in that kind of nostalgia, I was actually entering a long tradition of believing that baseball is dying. And when I started to see that unfold, I realized I had to be wrong. I couldn't be the first person who was right about this in 150 years. And I started to open my heart a bit, and I started to see the way that the pitch clock had people who were not baseball fans engaging with the game. Attendance went up, viewership went up, particularly among young people. And I really found that the game itself, it didn't feel that different to me. It reminded me of what I was finding in early newspaper reports. It felt a bit quicker. And in these early newspaper reports about baseball, they describe it as a game with vim and that you don't want to leave your seat. And then I started to feel that perhaps the pitch clock was taking us back to the original feeling of the game. It wasn't killing it. It was actually taking us, if what we want is to preserve the purity of the game on some level, that's what it was doing. And it taught me a spiritual lesson about embracing change. And the game should change, it should evolve. And ultimately I decided, you know what? Like, good. I want more people watching baseball. I want the game to grow. I want the game to evolve. That is magical. It is not dead. The magic is 100% present and alive in the game because it changes.
Well, we've been talking about a new book. It's out and available now. It's called The Magical Game. The subtitle is The Spirit and History of Baseball Superstitions, Rituals, and Curses. And the author is Addie Baird, who we've been talking about. Addie Baird, thank you so much. Pleasure.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you. And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.